This is a podcast featuring Kate Fletcher from the London College of Fashion and Mike Barry, Head of Sustainable Business at M&S. It was recorded on the 27th of April 2012 in London and covers broad themes in fashion and business.
Fantastic. Nice, interesting mix of people then. Okay, so one of the things that I was thinking about yesterday, and Kate and I had some discussion about this as well, is the idea that what Schwappen presents to us is the possibility that there may be different ways to experience fashion, and what does that actually look like for the business model? So I was going to kind of start maybe by asking both Kate and Mike, there's obviously some implications embedded in Schwappen that are to do with the idea that you know, we're not necessarily encouraging people to buy more, we're encouraging people to bring something back. And what is that going to mean for M&S's business model going forward? How's that going to be affected?
Yeah. I mean, maybe Kate, if I just take a couple of minutes, and then you can chip in against that. So I showed you some big numbers a moment ago: 24 million customers, 350 million items being produced in about 1,000 factories across the world, a lot of which that we own. We're using about 120,000 tons of fibre to make that clothing. So those are the bare facts. In M&S supply chain, there's about 1 million workers involved in producing that clothing, either in the factories, the dye houses, or back in the cotton fields, etc. So it's a huge operation. And as we project out over the next decade, it's quite scary. Because at the moment, if M&S sells about 350 million garments, now you're going to have to bear with some of my maths here, so I'm going to estimate what that means globally. That means there's about 4 billion items of clothing sold in the UK each year. I would guess that the UK is about 10% of the EU market for clothing. So multiply the 4 billion by 10, you get 40 billion items of clothing sold in the EU. EU is probably 40% of the global marketplace. It's probably 100 billion items of clothing sold each year in the world. Finger in the wind. I mean, it's just a guesstimate. Now, that is predominantly driven by about 1 billion middle-class affluent consumers around the planet, in the States, in Europe, Australia, Japan, etc. We know for the next decade or two, another 2 to 3 billion new middle-class consumers will enter that marketplace in India, in China, in Brazil, in Russia, Turkey, etc. Mm-hmm. Where is all the clothing going to come from? The clothing at the same level of consumption as we've got? Are we going to produce 300 billion items of clothing on the planet? With all the attendant cotton needs, polyester needs, chemical needs, water needs, the problem is that no stuff on the planet to service all that requirements from the consumption world. So Mark Spencer has started to project out and say, what could a very different world look like and how would we operate within it? And we keep coming back to the fact that the current business model that all clothing, scale clothing retailers have at the moment is that it's linear. You make things, you sell it, you use it, and then you chip it away. If we're going to be able to cope with the pressures that we're going to have over the next decade, environmentally, socially, and economically, flow from that, we have to start to create a clothing system. We have to be able to bring back everything that we sell. Now, the main thing that M&S sells is clothing that we can bring back. The food business we've got, the other half our business is probably less relevant there, much more to do on other sustainability factors. But how do you make produce a truly sustainable clothing business? Well, version 1.0 is what we've done for the last 5 years, where we've reduced the impacts of our factories, our farms, crop production. We've just made the existing business model less bad. We've used less energy in factories, we've improved labour conditions, we've used better cotton, less water in dye houses, all the basics of making an existing business model less bad. Version 2.0 of a sustainable clothing business we've entered now, which is Schwappen, which is starting to say, having produced all that goods to better environmental social standards that is the norm on the high street, we want to start bringing it back. And once we've brought it back, we can then work with a very good partner with Oxfam to distribute that clothing out to resell it in their second-hand shops, for them to ethically donate it in the developing world or to recycle some of it. That's version 2.0. And for a business that's got 21 million customers, we've got several years, I believe, to make Schwappen work and stick at scale. So I'm going to walk for a run. And that to me is that's the pragmatic nature of my job, is to come up with these great dreams, but then to make them stick. But be very clear, and Mark Spencer is very clear, that is just the beginning. There is a version 3.0 of a sustainable clothing business that is genuinely bringing back clothing in a different way, so everything is used to its maximum possible benefit, And there might be a version 4.0, which I think Pure Care would challenge me on, which is to think utterly differently about consumption. You consume less, you as a retailer can extract value from that in a different way. And I'm not going to sit here and pretend we have all the answers. Marks & Spencer will remain a successful commercial business into the future, but it will create value for itself and its shareholders in a very different way. So that is the journey that we're on. We're very humble and very clear we're at the beginning, not the end. But we think with Schwappin we've taken a significant extent to make the British consumer think differently about how to consume anything, starting with product. That's probably enough of me speechifying at the beginning.
Okay, do you want to respond to that in any way?
Well, I'm so glad that you said that there are all of these different versions stretching forward, because the way that it seems to me is that we have to sort of balance short-term interests and long-term interests, and it's almost like we all need to learn to work out, if you like, the muscle of prudence, because these questions that we're dealing with, actually, they need us to ask and answer some very difficult questions. Certainly, I agree that you're on the journey, but the spectre of consumption is huge. I mean, yesterday, the Royal Society had a report saying that everybody in the developed world really needs to stop consuming at the level it does. And for the Royal Society to be saying this, and saying also at the same time we need to engage the population, actually underscores the importance that we actually have to make some very, very difficult, profound, and ask some difficult and profound questions about what's going on here. To be quite frank, these questions are moral in nature, and they're not likely to be met through reorganising material consumption in the way that it's done at the moment, or even through the business models that we're dealing with. But that's a sort of a goal. We need to work out this muscle of prudence so that actually we realise that when we can't continue as we are. So I think what we have to do is we have to think about how society can be organised in a different way. And we have to think about configurations where actually what our goal is to maximise the way resources are used for the common good. And I would suggest that at the moment that's not happening. What we're doing at the moment is maximising the system so that profit is delivered to companies, including Marks & Spencer, but absolutely across the board. And that's a different and very important difference to understand. And I think it's really important that this is part of that bigger discussion. We have to think that. I would say that for me, Schwappin, even though I find it quite hard to say, maybe it's not just me, Scouse Girl, Schwappin. Oh, it's easier if I say Schwappin, right. Actually, I think it's amazing because actually, in a way, what it's doing, it's waking up an entirely new generation to participating and a worldview that's not based entirely on shopping as fashion. It's opening the door, even if it's just a small way, to thinking, okay, maybe fashion can be engaged with from a different perspective. I also think that what we have to do to change things, we have to appeal directly to the people. And we've been appealing to the government, maybe, or maybe to the CEOs of businesses, and actually, you know, I'm really fed up with that. We need to get political with a small p. We need to talk about democracy, and this is appealing over the heads of some of these big people directly to people on the streets, people, I suppose, like us. And I think that that's really essential.
Okay, can I just extend on some brilliant points there, because I share that analysis. The journey we are on is long and complex, and where we are today is a long way from sustainability. The challenge, the fundamental challenge of sustainability is not about technology. It's about people. It's about human beings behaving and thinking and acting differently, how they run businesses and how they think about consumption. Now, I mean, those 21 million customers we've got in Middle England, 10% of them, just 10% are passionate green, would even contemplate sitting and having this conversation with us here, and it would still probably be quite ancient for a number of them.
Can I ask, sorry, Mike, just to stop you in the middle, can you just define what you mean by passionately green and kind of interested to know where that...
So we've segmented our customers into four groups. 10% of them passionately green. They buy organic, they buy fair trade. They're probably willing to contemplate a slight premium for sustainability, not a huge one. They're knowledgeable, they're bright, they're learned. They take part in discussion. They will push M&S to do more than it does. There's 35% of our consumers then who are light green, who are basically saying, worried about the future, really want to make a difference, but how?
And if you, M&S, can make it easy for me to participate because it's simple, it's exciting, it's not costing me more, I don't need a PhD to understand it, I'll come with you. 35% a bit more apathetic, worried about the future, but what difference can I make? I give up. And actually what that group is looking to do is belong to what Kate's referring to as a tribe. We want to feel like we're all in this together. If I do one small thing this week, and everybody else does it, that's the difference. So put those three groups together, that's 80% of our customers are saying in some shape or form we want to go on a green journey, albeit most of them want to be led and inspired and helped by M&S. There's 20% who have no interest whatsoever. Even for an M&S, that is largely driven by income. That's the poorer sections of society who understandably have other preoccupations in their life, just getting by with it, for example. But there is 80%, we believe, of British society who in the right way can be engaged to live a very, very different lifestyle. So sorry for sort of interjecting there, Kate, but I just wanted to lay those numbers out in front of you and explain how shopping, or swapping, is trying to engage the 80% and move them forward together in different ways of thinking about it.
I would say that businesses create stuff because that's the business model that they're working with. And I think that it's really important that we stop talking and thinking about businesses and consumers. And actually we need to start talking about people perhaps as citizens. And it's a bit of a subtle shift maybe, but it's about a shift from I as an individual in a sort of self-interested way to a sense of we. I don't know whether swapping is a way to do that, but it seems to me that that's essential. There's lots of other things that I sort of feel is really important, and perhaps what's happening here is sort of at the cusp of all of this change. It's for too long, everybody who's engaging with fashion and sustainability, or fashion and textiles and garment sustainability, start at this whole issue from the point of view of producers. What are producers doing? And actually, from the last 20 years that I've been engaging with this subject, I started there too, and I've been on this sort of long and circuitous journey. And now I have this sort of revelation fairly recently, I suppose, in the last 5 years, that actually it's all about users. And when you begin to look at things, so recently I looked at some work around durability of garments, and when I began to look at that, I started up thinking, okay, maybe it's about the fibre. Is it about the way that it's constructed? Maybe it's something about the garment that makes it last. And the more you look at what makes things last, the less you realise it's anything actually to do with, well, a little bit to do with the product, but not overwhelmingly the product or even the producer. Actually, it's about the mindset of the user. So what you recognise is that durability, for example, if you instead of perhaps sustainability, we call it durability is all is an ideology of use. What we need to get around to thinking about, it's about people, it's about behaviour, and sustainability, as a consequence, is about nurture, not only nature of the garment, nature of the producer. It's about a much more complex, interrelated picture than anyone really talks about. And I think, to a small extent, swapping is the beginning, perhaps, of opening the door, even a chink, so that we can begin to see what's going on in people's lives and wardrobes and how they dress their bodies. That seems important to me.
Okay, I mean, one of the reasons we're doing this collaboration with London College down here is, over the next couple of weeks, is we, again, want to try and achieve that, but we want to work out how to do that. We've grown up in this consumption-led model of the last 30, 40 years. We've been very successful at it. We're holding our hand up now, so we need a different kind of business model in the future. But we need different kinds of collaboration to help people to understand and think and feel differently about clothing. Now, M&S does have half a step into that world in the sense that it's always been about quality. So if you talk to Oxfam about what clothing they love to have, it's M&S clothing because it's got longevity, it's got a better resale value. We've never lost that, even in this world of disposable fast fashion. People tend to buy M&S basics and garments because they last. Now, I'm not pretending that is, again, a step in the direction that we need to get to, but it shows that M&S has the potential and the values and way of thinking to prepare for this very different world that Kate is going to sketch out.
So, from what it seems to me that the crisis of unsustainability, if you can call it that, all the problems as wide-ranging as, you know, climate change to massive amounts of poverty to water shortages, the whole thing, it's been called a crisis of perception. And actually, it's also a crisis of imagination. And it seems at the moment that what's happening is that, you know, as consumers, the only way that we can figure out engaging with sustainability is to buy more, to consume more. And I think that this is, essentially, it's at the root of the problem. And actually, what we need to do is we need to sort of relocate our dreams and think about, actually, what are the ways in which we can live flourishing lives, not just a sort of a good life, a flourishing life, a life that actually contributes to society and to nature in different and diverse ways. And that's the goal. And the challenge is for these big retailers like M&S is to recognise and feel like you are part of a piece within this bigger trajectory.
Yeah. But again, I mean, this is not, I don't want this to just be an M&S conversation. I mean, as I travel and meet other big businesses, I see other businesses like the Unilevers, the Nikes of this world, waking up and seeing this. And they, like us, are at the stage of recognition rather than actually solving at the stage. But we're all looking up and thinking we can't carry on as we are. Not because government is telling us to stop, there's no regulation stopping us carrying on as we are. Not because consumers, there is a mass revolution today demanding it. But what we're seeing is signals from the consumers that they want to explore change. We're seeing very clear price signals happening in our current business model that says we can't carry on as we are. So in a very different language, a business language, and I will challenge us to keep using that business language, because if I go back to the office now, the M&S board would understand the language of customer research and cost. The challenging language that Kate's using would probably, not for any good reasons, but they wouldn't land with them. We have to keep using a business language to be able to keep nudging them in the right direction. So what I'm looking for is to find the optimum balance between the challenge you're setting, which is the right one, but also the practical, pragmatic business language that starts to nudge this super tanker in the right direction.
Okay, so just picking up on the point of language, though, I think it's a really interesting one. I think about language quite a lot. So I was digging around a little bit, and I'm not a linguist, but there was a hypothesis called the linguistic relativity hypothesis, which I discovered. I think it's got lots of flaws to it, but there are some ideas in it which really, I think, are very useful to and pertinent to a discussion around language. And effectively, it says the words that you use shape the ideas that you form. And so, I mean, the classic example is that communities who don't really have a word for violence, they are largely peaceable communities. And so I would actually suggest that rather than going back and just speaking the business language to the board, actually what you need to do is you need to be talking about the language of the future that we want, or the present that we want to see to them, not the language of business yesterday. So the language actually is, and it's open for negotiation. I think if you can go back to them and say, I don't know, love and empathy, and they go, great, and then I would be a happy woman.
So I'm going to ask you. You set me a challenge.
I will, but it's, yeah, you know.
But again, what you painted here, Kate, is where we need to get to. And I think, again, the language that we have, the journey we have got on, the 1.0 to the 2.0 version of language here, even 3 years ago, this was about risk management. Stop bad things from happening in our supply chain, our factories, because good journalists might track it down and expose it. The language in M&S in the last year or two is utterly inverted now to opportunity. Now, again, that's quite a cold, pragmatic word. It's opportunity rather than risk. It's a sea change in the culture of M&S about being willing to explore how to run itself business differently. Love is probably version 4.0. Believe me. But we're on the trajectory to head in that direction. Not as fast as you'd like.
I know. Mike and I have been actually talking for a decade, or actually more than that now, about these things. So it's a long conversation this is part of. But there's other things that I would really like to raise. And I think that, you know, the consumer society is so prevalent in our sense and experience of what fashion is that we don't really notice it anymore. It's really dominant. That's the way that we interact with fashion. And I also think that the consumer society only values a very narrow range of activity. So it's very hard for lots of things that I would consider to be moving towards sustainability to even get off the ground because of the way that the consumer society, which tends to promote itself and self-justifies, values only a very narrow range of what is possible. And to a certain extent, one could argue that businesses are part of that problem because it's just valuing stuff, basically, which is exchange money for goods in shops. And it promotes it. Yeah, and so that's really part of the problem. So I hope that, and I, as well as to use love and empathy in the next meeting, the board meeting, I would also challenge you to perhaps have a conversation about what other broader things can be valued within the business. Because
isn't that where this idea, we're talking about when we're talking about the whole shopping idea, isn't that the seed that possibly it is planting to some extent? The idea that the experience is not just about hand over money, take your goods, dispose of them, you know, that you are engaging with the possibility that things may, you know.
Yeah, and this is a recognition of a very different shopping environment. I mean, in the past, we could rely on loyalty, that people would keep coming back to us because my mum shopped with M&S and my grandmum did. Not now. People will have no specific loyalty to a brand in the old 20th century way, unless you create a new kind of empathy relationship between you and the consumer. And again, what we're trying to explore here is how can a business deliver some functional needs? There will always be a price dimension in there, there will always be a quality dimension, the more functional things, a fashion dimension. But how can you create a different dimension as well to how you interact with not the consumer, the citizen, and the communities in which you trade in a different way? And I'm accepting that analysis, but constantly I must keep coming back to, and how do I get a business with its feet still in the 20th century start to come in a different direction? Now, I think the hope is, to me, there is one big hope here. There are three generations of people out there that shop at the moment. The core M&S customer, 50+, grew up in a generation when they were shaped as youngsters, which was not a disposable throwaway society. They remember when you may do a mend. You talk to your mum, your grandmum, it's like, why do we live this crazy world with everything going to the bin? For them, waste is crazy. And they've been sucked into this consumer-driven society, but equally they can come out of it as well. There is a group of consumers starting half my age, in their teens and early 20s, who through new technologies, new ways of interacting, can live a much less material world, but have a fantastic time as well, potentially. There is a group in the middle, probably in their 30s and 40s, who know nothing but consumption. And for them, it's probably the hardest job to repurpose and get them to think differently about products. But they're the three different groups that we can work with.